And folks said, Jed, move away from there. Said, California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is. Swimming pools, movie stars.
Yeah.
Whoa. I guess we ended that.
That, young people. Was a theme to an old-timey television show.
A sitcom.
Yes, the Beverly Hillbillies.
All about how hicks from Texas come to Beverly Hills teaching greater truths to the rich and powerful.
Yes, and establishing the timeless archetype that says if you find oil, then all your problems are solved.
And that your simple homey ways are better than the more sophisticated ways of the hyper-educated.
That's right. Ivory Tower elite intellectuals.
Yeah, let's hate them. All right, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. I'm starting to imitate the thing. Sorry about that. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call, 231-8187. I'm actually pushing this. I want to talk. I hope this isn't boring to you all, but I want to talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. Yeah, tar sands.
Right.
That's the call of tar sands. Periodically throughout this program, that voice of Johnny Weissmuller may be heard.
Right.
Tar sands.
I'm sure it won't get old either.
And you hate that. I know you just hate that. I can't help it. I like puns. All right. First of all, the first thing to understand, I don't know if everyone's clear on this, there already is an XL pipeline.
Yeah, part of it.
No. Actually, a line goes from the tar sands area over into the eastern part of the Midwest and is a transfer point for oil going to the East Coast. And it goes down, and it does eventually end up in the Gulf of Mexico. There's already a pipeline there. It's not as big, and it's not designed for tar sands, but it carries them.
I see.
That's number one. Number two, tar sands oil is already flowing to the Pacific on rail cars. These are two facts.
Yes.
And let's talk a little bit about tar sands oil. Tar sands oil is bitumen, and that means it isn't really oil. It's a tarry substance, a mixture of sand and various chemicals and all kinds of dreck. That's the technical term.
Dreck.
Yes. And it lies just under the surface throughout a huge area of Alberta, Canada. And it's if you can imagine, it's like sandy mud but soaked with a smelly oily substance.
Oily sandy mud.
And you pick this oily sandy mud out of the ground, and immediately when you open it up, you pull it out. Huge amounts of hydrocarbons and various really toxic chemicals are released into the atmosphere. Then you take this sludge and you have to heat it, which in turn increases the amount of hydrocarbons because, of course, you use fuel to heat it. Then when you've got it to the place where it is a thick, gooey liquid, you start pumping it through a pipe that goes down, if this plan is completed, will go down directly over the Ogallala Aquifer to Texas, where it will be processed into a usable oil, again producing more releasing of hydrocarbons. Then it will be shipped to China and India and any place that wants to buy it. And it will make people who are involved quite wealthy.
No.
Yeah. And that is the plan. But
what's wrong with that?
Oh, nothing.
The oil's there, right?
Yeah, the oil's there.
It's going to be burnt, right? But we might as well get it on the party, right?
Well,
it's going to put people to work. It'll raise share prices. Your 401k will become more valuable.
It will create jobs for 1,950 people while it's being built. That's all. After it's built, the number will be down in the hundreds, less than 100.
Well, I thought it was a great windfall. I thought it was a great employment machine.
I guess if you're in Dakota, it helps.
2,000 people.
Yeah.
While it's being built.
Yeah.
How long will that be?
3 years.
3,000 people will be employed for 3 years, 50 people a year after that, and that's it.
Well, kind of, yeah. 1,179 miles long.
I see.
Again, going right over the most precious supply of water that is in the nation that feeds us. It is the oil, it is the water from which we draw to make our corn and our soybeans and our wheat and our cowies and our piggies and our chickens.
I see.
So if, of course, nothing could ever go wrong, but if this pipe is well maintained, then that isn't so bad for the aquifer. But if it leaks, and we all know how much we can trust the oil industry, because look how well they did with the Exxon Valdez. Look how lovely they were in the Gulf of Mexico.
For that sinkhole in Arkansas.
Or how about the current situation in West Virginia on the coal industry? No, we should trust these people.
We should, yeah. And well, I'm still trying to get my brain around how very few people will actually be employed by this. So it's going to, a whole bunch of wealth is going to be pulled out of the sands in Canada.
Yes.
But very, very little of that is going to actually go to working people.
Really, actually, very little.
Almost none.
It's in Canada, the current reactionary government wants this project. The current Prime Minister of Canada is actually from Alberta. And Alberta has moved into a very kind of reactionary political stance as a province within Canada. So in the terms of the politics of Canada, this is something that is not appreciated in Montreal or Toronto or Quebec or any of those places.
Vancouver.
There is already a pipeline going from Alberta over the Rockies, I guess through the Rockies, to Vancouver. It's a smaller pipeline. There is a perceived great challenge in shipping it out of Vancouver. So the preference is not to build a pipeline through the Rockies, through the pristine, marvelous forests and wondrous lands of the wildlands of the Rockies.
All right, not to get all territorial here, but if Canada has this oil, wants to extract it and refine it, wants to ship it overseas, why not ship it out of Canada?
Because the oil industry is predominantly in the United States, I guess, and because this is an easier route in terms of the cost per mile of building the pipeline.
Huh.
So it is said.
Huh. And you know, damn any aquifers that happen to be in the way.
Yeah. Well, they moved the pipeline a little bit in the planning so that it's less directly over the aquifer. But it's still there. And, you know, what we're really being told here is that the oil industry is very responsible. Look at its past history. Trust it.
Hmm.
Now, that's the bad case scenario. Gesundheit. The good case, sorry, the good case scenario is that it'll help the economies in Kansas and Montana and Nebraska and South Dakota.
Hmm.
Sort of. But as you say, very few jobs. If you consider this in realistic terms, the amount of oil pumped out of this is significant. But remember, it is bitumen. It is not oil like out of the crude oil well of Texas or California or even Pennsylvania. It is, in fact, a gooey, tarry, nasty substance that has to be extremely processed in order to be liquid enough to move through the pipes. And when it's in the pipes, it is very corrosive. It is full of sand and other substances. It is kind of always an accident waiting to happen. And the question always also is, well, can you really trust these people to do right by that pipe?
I doubt it.
No, I think not. And it adds an enormous hydrocarbon burden, tremendous hydrocarbon burden at its source, where it's processed so it can be pumped. Then it creates more and more dirty fuel, which puts out huge hydrocarbons all over the world, all of which, most of which will probably end up in China. And then, of course, prevailing winds being what they are, we get to breathe whatever it is released in China as it's burned.
Nice.
Meanwhile, this thing is a real big problem in a lot of ways. Supposing, first of all, I think it's going to be built. I think Obama doesn't have the courage or the will to say no. So that's what I think. I could be wrong, but the Department of State, which was supposed to look at it environmentally, has essentially abnegated abrogated that responsibility, and is saying, oh, it's all cool. So the go ahead, there's nothing now to stop it. There'll be lawsuits, there'll be delays, there'll be process, there'll be fights, there'll be people getting arrested, there'll be outrage. 350.org will scream and yell. But the fact of the matter is that this oil is part of the what drives the current and modern capitalist system. It will be used. It will go out, whether it goes out as pipeline oil or in a way more expensively and perhaps even more dangerously, it will be put on rail cars. And interestingly enough, a lot of it will be going through Portland, Oregon.
A lot of it's already going through
Portland. Yeah, actually it is. Yeah. And so we are seeing the logic of an oil-based economy. And we are seeing the power of capital. And I'm getting a little fed up with this whole thing. I feel like there's not going to be any eco-solution without revolution. Now, how are you going to have a revolution in a modern world without creating some kind of quasi-fascist or hyper-pseudo-communist thing? I don't know.
What? What's that?
That's like what Russia was.
Quasi-fascist, hyper-pseudo-communist?
Yeah.
You do realize that fascism and communism are opposite ends of the...
I understand that. Right. I understand okay. that in a political science theoretical model. But if you look at...
It sounds like you just threw a whole bunch of negative buzzwords together in one phrase and
I made up
something new.
I hope so. Okay. I hope I'm right, because what I believe now is that when you have a ruling class that profits and has control of the military power in society and silences dissent and so on, the distinction between that as fascism, with wars as a way to fuel the economy, and the situation that the Soviet Union evolved or devolved into are not much different. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, we immediately saw a development of an oligarchic class coming initially out of the very successful ruling class, equal partners, comrades in the Soviet system. So, you know, I've gone through a lot of changes in my life. I used to be a pacifist, totally pacifist. I still am, largely. And I used to be kind of an anarchist.
Used to be a fashionable dresser.
And I still am.
All right.
People faint when they see me. But the thing is, I'm beginning to become more and more cynical and more convinced that without the ability to have a meaningful movement through media and through a really meaningful dialogue and through a really meaningful political participation and political system with real political parties, we are not anywhere close to having democracy.
Well, I have to agree with you there.
So, you know, this pipeline is symptomatic to me of the failures of modern post-industrial capitalism.
So here's where we stand now.
Yes.
This project, because it crosses an international border, that's the one between Canada and the United States, needed to be approved by the United States Department of State before the project could be granted its final approval. The environmental report commissioned by the State Department, which was just handed in a couple of days ago, was the final step in this evaluation. And we expect Secretary of State John Kerry to render a final decision on this soon. Now, you can bet that his decision will not actually be his. It will be the president's. And he will be speaking with the president's voice on this. So that's where we are. The report from the State Department says, no big deal. It concludes that the environmental risks are minimal. And besides, somebody's going to dig up this oil anyway, might as well be part of the party.
Exactly. And, you know, this is 1 million barrels per day of oil moving through this pipeline or through the rail cars or whatever. And I guess a point really I need to make clear, this bitumen isn't a liquid. So it's temporarily liquefied until it's fully processed. It's strip mined. It's crushed. It's mixed with very volatile fluids. And it makes a slurry. And that slurry, which is very very toxic and very rough, very caustic.
And a great deal of fresh water is used in this process. Also.
And it eats pipes. It definitely eats pipes. So there will have to be constant maintenance, constant evaluation. And the same would be true for rail cars. Most modern rail cars are not double-walled. They're not protective of explosion. The whole adventure depends upon luck staying with the oil industry. And we have all seen how
that works. I don't
think
luck has anything to do with it.
Well, it's all it's got to do with it because everything else is dangerous.
Cash staying with
cash
the oil industry.
Cash is what it's got to do with.
Let's take some phone calls.
Yeah, maybe I'm just being too dark about this. Hey, Larry, how are you?
Hey, I just want to offer one slight correction, Joe, in your introduction.
Well, I'm sure I was wrong all the way.
No. You made several references to these people, and these are corporations running this program.
Yeah, they're not people. You're right.
They are non-human entities, and so everybody is playing to this music of a non-human structure.
Well, in the eyes of the law, they're humans.
Yeah, right. Well, I just didn't want to support that. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that
in. I'm glad you pointed that out. It's really difficult to use language effectively in the modern world of lying language.
Right. No, I understand.
Yeah, no, appreciate that.
Yep.
You know, this is, I want to just, thanks
Thank
for calling.
Call.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
I just want to point out that it means $3.4 billion to the U.S. economy. Not jobs, dollars.
Of which a very small proportion would actually go to working people.
Well, yeah, and there's a little bit of tax money that comes out of it, a little bit of revenue, a little bit. Not much.
Well, see, the reason I keep returning to that, how many people will be able to earn a living from this project, is because essentially that's the almost the trump card that's thrown out from the business side of the equation when such projects are talked about. Oh, the jobs. Think of the jobs that this will create.
Yes.
Think of the families that this will help support. Well, there really aren't very many families.
Not really very many. And, you know, the construction of it is the big money thing, and that's only a few years. But think of this. We get to breathe regularly even more of what we already know the oil industry produces, including polycyclic aromatics. Mm. These are hydrocarbons that are really toxic. And there's enormous degrees of toxic weight in this whole oil area already being released just by the processing of this stuff. Just by heating it, we release this stuff, and it's not capturable, and it doesn't have any real function except to poison the atmosphere.
Well, it powers capitalism, Joe.
It does. And then there's the phenol... the pyrene, benzopyrene, all these incredibly known to be carcinogenic and highly toxic and lung-eating distillates that come out of the process of moving this oil, of getting it out of the ground, of processing it so it can go into a pipe as a sludge, moving that very, very caustic sludge through the pipes all the way down to Texas where it is processed and more aromatics of this sort are released, and then it goes to China where it's burned as efficiently or inefficiently as the Chinese are capable of doing it. Or India or Bangladesh or, you know, you name it. So this is, I mean, to me, this is a real example of a disaster. Now, there's been a lot of work by 350.org, which argues that that's the tipping point and it's already been exceeded. The fact of the matter is that if the movement can stop the pipeline, it will not stop the oil. And I'm very depressed about this because I think we have lost control. The ordinary people of the world have lost control totally of the rational approach to energy. We do not see the production of renewable resources at the level that we should have seen by now. We do not see concern about the poisoning of the atmosphere and the groundwater and our lives that we should have seen by now. And I don't think we're gonna. I'm depressed. Cheer me up. Call me up. Tell me we can win.
That's both true and not true. There are those people who have seen it for a long time.
Yes.
There are those people who have warned against things like this for a long time.
Yes.
There are those people who have advocated a switch away from hydrocarbon-based energy for a long time.
Yes.
The problem is they are opposed by a monolithic and very, very wealthy and entrenched industry. that will do just about anything to ensure that we don't transition away from hydrocarbons until we extract every last drop.
Well, and what the Department of State did was underestimate the impact of the tailings. That's the stuff that's not that is left after the bitumen product is crushed and turned into a sludge and put into the pipes. There's no discussion of the existing and future ponds, the waste ponds that will be open to the air, producing all manner of these toxic chemicals that are part of this product into the atmosphere. No discussion of the dust that is created. It doesn't just blow all around in Calgary or something. It blows around in the entire world. There's no real discussion of the terrible environmental damage and the terrible damage to human lungs, to human beings, period, that is involved in all this. And I keep waiting for something to happen that will make it better. You know, something.
Yeah, it wasn't any funnier that time.
Yeah, you really hate that, but I like the pun. I like Tarzan and Tar Sands.
Let's go back to
I don't
the
know.
Puns.
Yeah, see, you're laughing. I know it's not. I can't help it.
Brian,
I like puns.
Brian, good morning. Save us, please.
Oh, I don't know if I can save you. Sounds like we need to get something in there besides Tarzan.
Yeah, I don't know. I like Tarzan,
we
man.
Need maybe we need Superman. But, you know, I mean, real quick, I would think that along the line of the Beverly Hillbillies, If Jed discovered this oil, then Jethro is running the company that's digging it up, you know, because Jethro can do anything, you know.
Well, see, this is a reference to an old sitcom.
Absolutely.
I don't know where to go with that.
Jethro was going to be a brain surgeon.
I know.
And so anyway, so he can obviously run an oil company. You know, my point is NPR had a special, you know, little report, and what's taking up the wages of all those employees that got all those jobs up there digging up the oil is there, of course, the rents are sky high, you know, probably.
Oh, you mean at the site?
I'm sorry?
You mean at the site?
At the site.
Yeah, it's like the North Slope, the same problem developed there where the huge numbers of people went up to work in the oil industry, and then it turned out that it was very expensive just to exist there.
And the oil companies with their wisdom and also, you know, they're self-policing, have allowed an enormous amount of drugs into the site, as well as prostitution. There's plenty of, all of a sudden, in the middle of nowhere, there's plenty of women for hire, and, you know, it turns into like the gold rush, you know, payday comes, everybody's in town, and of course there's liquor flowing and drugs available everywhere and prostitution. So these guys who all went out to North Dakota or wherever for their family are now consumed with high rents, you know, drugs and prostitution.
Man, I'm in the wrong line of work.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to go work 12 hours a day and then blow it all in town, you know, the company store, I'm sure, will set you right up. But,
yeah.
You know, is this what we're looking at? You know, work camps, you know, of old, and you know, all these vices that are set up.
Well, this is part of a long-term tradition of exploiting natural resources. I mean, all of the gold towns, all of the lead mining, all of the mining of copper, all of this is accompanied by what you're describing, and it's part of the history of the West,
right,
including Oregon.
And it's the old West. There's psychology and sociology and all kinds of things, you know, that have come about since those old times happened. And, you know, the fact is that this stuff is being allowed to perpetuate, you know, is obviously, it doesn't, we all know it doesn't perpetuate without the helping hand of...
Well.
Corporations.
Yeah, but I mean, see, the argument for it is really simple. It will produce, this is what they claim, $3.4 billion more dollars to our economy, which is currently lagging generally. And, of course, it does mean 17% more carbon will be produced than you would have from a cleaner crude. But never mind, because look, this is going to make us richer. Who is us? I ask you, well, you know, it's not you or me, very likely.
Exactly. So that's my observation of it. And of course, you know, the pipeline is wrong, you know, period. And trucking coal by train is wrong. But our president has rolled over on every single issue since his initial promise of closing Guantanamo. So, I mean, you know what? I mean, I'm not depressed about it, but what in 6 years of being in office, what do we expect from this person?
Well, and also I have to say, and I'm going to let you go.
Yeah, okay? I'm going to go.
Yeah, but I have to say that we like to heap abuse on Obama as if he were Superman. Or Tarzan. No, don't play the Tarzan song.
No, please.
Okay. Anyway.
And have a good day.
Thank you. But the fact of the matter is that we have a so reactionary and gerrymandered Republican Congress that you cannot expect anything to be accomplished. Now, would Obama have been way better if he had had a strong Democratic Congress? Probably. Does it matter to us now? In essence, it doesn't, because what we are stuck with is what we got. All right, cheer me up.
Okay,
hey,
Bob,
I'm asking you, please, cheer me up.
Environmental activist Bill McKibben of 350.org.
Yeah, we had him
on our
show.
On this show.
Yeah.
This is what he had to say upon the release of the State Department's report a few days ago. In a conference call with reporters, McKibben said, I'm quoting here from the New York Times, this report gives President Obama everything he needs in order to block this project. Well, what is he talking about here? He's talking about the fact that President Obama is on record saying that he will not approve this project if it can be shown that its construction will significantly add to carbon emissions in the atmosphere. I think by any measure, we can conclude that, yes, it will significantly contribute to carbon emissions in the atmosphere. The problem is that the report is written such that it frames the construction of the pipeline as a better, more carbon-friendly alternative than either shipping oil by truck or by rail. They say, look, a whole bunch less carbon will be released into the atmosphere if we build the pipeline than if we don't. But that's essentially setting up a fool's choice. What do we take, this poison that will kill us a little more slowly? Or do we take this poison that will kill us more quickly? So while Obama may have been on the record saying, I will oppose this thing, he now has the ability to say, look, I'm making the least bad choice by approving this pipeline. Look at how much worse it would have been if we just allowed this stuff to be shipped by rail.
Well,
which, of course, is a snow job.
Yeah, and I take a more radical view. I think the deal was done way back when, and that it only takes a while of argumentation and struggling against the environmental community and the power of the oil industry, dominant power all over this country, to make it happen. And now we're just at the place, just at the turning point where they're getting ready to build the pipeline. They're already digging the ditches. They're already building the pipe, creating the pipe. And it doesn't seem to me that anybody in the political center, in the power centers, has the will to say no. And until that will exists, which I cannot imagine it developing in the present economic climate and in the present political climate, until that will exists, it's simply going to have to happen. It and many other bad, long-term bad projects, which will produce wealth for the wealthiest and some jobs for the rest of us, will happen.
Now, I think that will is there, and that will can still be marshaled. This is Lindsay Abrams reporting in Salon yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Her piece begins, "It isn't over yet." She then goes on to quote a report from Reuters. White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough said Obama would decide once the EPA, Energy Department, and other federal experts offer their assessments of the State Department review. That's the report we've been talking mm-hmm. about that was released 3 days ago,
mm-hmm.
As well as their own analysis. So the president is at least making noise, saying that this report is not the be-all, end-all of his assessment of this.
Maybe
project.
I'm unfair. Maybe I'm too dark.
No, I can totally understand your cynicism. And you know what? You're probably right.
But you know, there are I wanted to mention this. Is it okay if I interrupt you for a second?
Well, clearly you've already done it, so.
All right. Look, there are demonstrations. In fact, I would like a caller to tell me where and when today because I know it's today, there are demonstrations in Portland, Oregon. So that's a call I really hope we get. But go ahead, Abe. I'm sorry.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's still daylight here. The decision has not been yet rendered. And I think that, you know, Obama, if nothing else, is a skilled politician and will want to be able to cover his assets, as it were. And if he were to render a decision based solely upon the outcome of the State Department report, he would be open for a hell of a lot of criticism, saying, well, didn't you ask your Environmental Protection Agency to weigh in?
No.
Didn't you ask your Energy Department to weigh in? Your Transportation Department to weigh in? So there's still some room here. There is still a way to marshal the considerable public opposition to this project and to bring that energy to his attention.
Well, I agree. I shouldn't be as dark and grim as I am right now, and this is an emotional response on my part. It does not mean that this fight cannot be won. It just means that all the people who know better than this have got to be mobilized and actually make their voices heard in a variety of ways. I suspect there's going to have to be a lot of civil disobedience. I suspect that this is a struggle as difficult or perhaps more difficult than the struggle undergone in the South to create voting rights for African Americans.
Well, I don't know about that.
This is bad. This is
it's really bad.
You're going against, you know, you're going against enormous power that has gained control of the Congress of the United States through gerrymandering and other mechanisms that essentially serve the interests of a ruling class.
But we do have one thing going for us, though.
What's that?
That civil disobedience is good fun.
Up to a point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Juan, good morning.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Good. How are you, sir?
The other thing, I think you sort of missed one disaster.
I couldn't have missed a disaster. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the Kalamazoo River in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes.
I think that was a bitumen spill.
I think you're right, actually.
And they're nowhere near finished cleaning it up, and it's cost a lot more than they said it was going to cost, and people are getting sick.
Right.
If you don't care about the fact that we're... Well, I mean, there's so many reasons this is not a good idea. We're screwing the First Nations again up in Canada.
Yep.
They're getting cancer because they live around here. I've got an email from nextgenclimate.org that shows a before and after shot of what the land looks like. Pristine wilderness on one side, and then you've got what looks like a landscape on the other. And, I mean, there's just no good reason for doing this other than the 1% will make some more money.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think, I'm glad you mentioned this. Bitumen is not like regular crude oil. Once it gets into water, it sinks, not floats. It disperses easily. It becomes really toxic, giving off enormous amounts of toxic fumes. There's no known way to effectively clean it up. And I'm glad you mentioned the Kalamazoo thing.
They're going to put this through the largest aquifer in the western Midwest.
Right. See,
how many million people are drinking that water?
Well, they're not just drinking that water. That's our source. That's our source of our actual real wealth. That's where our corn, our wheat, our soybeans are grown, and that's where all the meat products are consequently produced.
You know, our kids and our grandkids are just gonna, when they figure out what's going on, it's gonna be the giant WTF. What were you people doing?
Well, there's a lot of things that might fit that description, but you're right.
No, you're absolutely right, and I'm glad you mentioned Kalamazoo. I'd sort of left it off because I just was kind of overwhelmed with the data. I think what we know is that this is a bad idea. I think the other thing we know is that it's really hard to stop a bad idea when it's going to make money for very few, very powerful, very wealthy people in a system which is rigged for the powerful.
Joe, let me cheer you up.
Okay, please.
Sack up. We don't have any choice. We can't let this happen.
Well, you're right.
That's
it. And I need a call from somebody, because I didn't get it done last night because I'm so lazy. I need a call from somebody to give me when and where there's going to be some action on this in the streets in Portland, Oregon, today, I believe, or not, if not today, tomorrow. So if you know the answer to that, call us. And thank you for the call.
I'll send you an email.
Yeah, send an email. Right.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks a lot. Ooh.
All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University, speaks on the Olympics, celebration capitalism.
Yes. So cheap. You know, you like the Olympics, don't you?
At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a critique of Obama's protesting policy in the public schools. Commentary by Mark Carlin, a buzz flash at Truth Out, and an exclusive interview with a former Haitian senator falsely accused of killing Haiti's most famous journalist. At 11 on stage and studio, host D-Mae Roberts interviews Bill Foster, executive director of the Northwest Film Center, about the 37th Portland International Film Festival. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan hosts a digital art panel with Stephen Slapp, Crystal South, and Theo Downs Le Guin. They'll discuss net art, mobile apps, art that exists only in computers, glitch art, and the backlash against software and slick finishes.
I got to tell you, if art exists only in the computer, then the computer is the art source. It's the museum. What is that? Never mind. Let's not get into that.
Joe, with every passing day, you become more of a Luddite, my friend.
I think so, and I think I'm right.
No.
Oh, I think I'm right.
Who's next, Steve? Michael is now calling us on a telephone machine.
Oh.
Do you have one of those at your house?
What's that?
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
So, first of all, I want the engineer to be ready to cue that sound because I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
What does Tarzan do to Jane at night, and who is Jane in this scenario?
we ain't going there.
I see. Okay.
All right. But you got your Tarzan, which just angers the hell out of Abe. I think I almost do it because of that.
Is that actually Johnny Weissmuller does that sound?
That's actually Johnny Weissmuller. Yeah. That's the real original one. In the first Tarzan movie, Jane and Johnny got kind of naked, and they had to cut that back.
Oh, my.
They jumped in the water.
So. Oh, I see.
Not relevant to this show.
All right, what's on your mind, Michael?
Okay, first a very quick point about pipelines, and then my main point. The very quick point about pipelines is, I remember hearing all of this disaster scenario, prediction going on before and during the time they built that pipeline across Alaska.
Oh, there was a movement, and nobody liked it, but it's true that it got built.
And not only that, I remember in one particular thing, it was going to destroy the caribou herds because they couldn't migrate and stuff. Well, that oil has to be heated to go through that pipeline because, you know, it's Alaska, it's very cold. And it turned out the caribou used to like to cluster under the pipeline because it was warm and they liked it, actually, and it didn't hurt them at all. So first of all, I'm really skeptical about all of this, you build a pipeline like that and horrible disasters will happen. It didn't happen with the Alaska one. Never happened.
Well, do you count the various spills like the Exxon Valdez as something?
No, the Valdez was an oil tanker disaster.
Yeah,
yes,
but it only
loaded with crude oil that came through the Alaska pipeline.
Yeah, it could only happen with the pipeline.
That's like not any problem with anything about a pipeline, though. That's a problem of a different kind.
No, I think you're making a point that's significant. It is possible to build a safe pipeline, probably.
Yeah.
Although there are odds against that lasting for a long period of time. If you make a dedicated pipeline and you maintain it and you replace its various parts as needed, it is possible to avoid disaster with it.
They could even build it above ground like the Alaska pipeline was built.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, it's possible. So anyway, that was a small point. The bigger point I want to make is that while I unfortunately don't remember the name of the article, I read an article this week that described, it was kind of a class analysis of this Keystone XL issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting because what it said was that in many areas, including the area of this pipeline, but also things about logging and so on, that the coastal elites, who are not negatively affected by all of this, are effectively preventing the rural blue-collar class from having any way at all to make a living. You take what's happening to the ONC counties down, in southern, southwestern Oregon. You take, this pipeline, which would lead to not 3,000 or 1,000, but 41,000 jobs, when you look at the follow-on effects of, you know, now this guy that has a job goes and he buys a sandwich someplace and he rents an apartment and so on.
Opposition to the pipeline is the oppression of the heartland states, the hardworking blue-collar heartland residents by the liberal elitist oppressors on the coast.
Well, that's what the article said, and it made a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, you look at what's happening to rural places in this country, and you look at, you know, who it is that's doing it to them and making it impossible to earn any kind of decent living out of rural places. And it's, you know, basically environmentalists in cities don't really give a rip about anything that happens to those people in the rural places.
Well, I think you're making a really interesting point. And I think you're.
No, I don't find it particularly.
Well, no, I do, because I think there really is an important aspect to this, which is that by turning the educated elites into the bad guys and the regular, that is, you know, ordinary, common man, into the good guy suffering from lack of jobs and being blocked, it creates a false class analysis because it doesn't really deal with the larger and more profound significance of what's happening to the environment as a whole. And Michael, you know that. I mean, you're making a good argument in the sense that, well, yes, certain people perceive the problem, other people need the jobs. And I think that is the contradiction that is inherent in this. How many jobs we could argue and what the long-term effect or the impact is on subway shops and so on, and, you know, that becomes kind of technical and less significant. But your point does go to the heart of what's going on in the culture at this time. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that point. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
You know, and I was an environmentalist. I was a member of Greenpeace. I was like, well...
What happened to you, Michael? Well, how did you lose your soul?
Well, you
man?
Know, it was like I joined Greenpeace because they're going to kill the last whale. There won't be any more whales. They're going to, you know,
yeah, yeah.
In the 70s, right?
Right.
Then it turned out that, well, it wasn't just the whales. It was also, we can't build a dam because of something called a snail darter. Or it was... We can't build an observatory on top of a mountain in Arizona because there's something there called the red ground squirrel that's like
yes.
Just like every other red ground squirrel in the whole state of
yes.
Arizona.
Yes, environmental is so much easier when the big sexy animals are involved. I know, it's just tedious when you start talking about these smaller species.
Those red ground squirrels that they didn't want to build the observatory over, they were red ground squirrels just like that on every adjacent hill, but because the hills are kind of isolated from each other, they figured out, well, this is a unique species of red ground squirrel because, you know, they've been up on that hill for a while.
So, wait, I want to cut through...
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, I want to cut through this, Michael. You said that you were an environmentalist, and because yeah. things have become highly technicalized and
highly extreme.
And extreme, that you no longer hold that position. Let me ask you one question. Do you believe that increasing the hydrocarbon load of the atmosphere is dangerous and not a wise thing?
You mean the carbon dioxide load?
The hydrocarbons. No, I'm not even talking about carbon dioxide. I'm talking about the actual hydrocarbon release that accompanies this kind of mining, this kind of basically strip mining to produce bitumen, to then heat the bitumen and then put it in a pipe and then transfer it down to Texas and then process it into crude oil and then ship it somewhere else where it's burned.
And meanwhile, it evaporates? Is that what you're saying?
A huge amount does, yes.
So we end up with hydrocarbons in the atmosphere?
Yes.
That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
I don't think that's a good thing, and I think they should limit that to the extent possible. But, like, I'm not especially willing to not be able to drive a car or to go back to rubbing the two sticks together. It's sort of like everything's a trade-off. Let's be as responsible as we can, but what kind of lives do we want to live?
Yeah, Michael, that's reductio ad absurdum, what you're proffering there. We're not talking about going back to rubbing sticks together. I don't think anybody has proposed that, nor is the ultimate outcome of the environmental movement the abandonment of a modern industrial society. Nobody's talking about any of those things.
It's actually the case that people are talking about that, because I read widely in all of this, and when you get down into something called deep ecology, there are people talking about exactly that.
I'm going to agree with you to one extent. The need for change, the need for moving away from where we're going, is a radical and deep problem. And it's not wrong to say, as you're saying, look, this is not some minor problem. This is a major problem. Where you and I probably disagree is whether or not the species, that's us, and other species, that's all of them, can survive in an environment that becomes increasingly hostile to life itself. And I honestly believe, looking at data, and I have looked at a lot of data, that what we are producing is an increasingly toxic environment. And that is, that including CO2, including global warming, and that is not a wise thing to do. And I think actually, probably when you think about it, you think about it in the same terms I do, but you have a rationalization which is based on the fact that there are a lot of absurd demands made in the process of trying to save the environment.
If it stayed on the level of common sense, I would probably totally agree with you. All the chemicals we're releasing into the environment are a really bad idea as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, well, okay, on the one hand you have industrial society doing what they're doing, and on the other hand you have extreme environmentalists who would just be so destructive of many things that I also care about that I got to make a choice of where to come down, and I came down where I came down.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of people fall between those two extremes.
That's fine.
Okay, listen, okay. I appreciate your thoughts on this, and I'm going to let you go.
That sounds good. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael. I got to take issue with something you just said, though, Joe.
Oh, okay.
You talked about, you said it's a bad idea to release hydrocarbons and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere such that we create conditions that are threatening to life itself.
Yes.
I think that's a misrepresentation of the problem.
Well,
because
why?
We can heat up the planet, and the planet will endure. Life will endure.
Oh,
the
question is, I shouldn't have said life itself. I should have said human society as we know it.
Human society as we know it, or human beings as we know them. And to me, that's a legitimate grounds for environmental activism. Yes, let's try and preserve the conditions that led to our own evolution. It's self-centered, but hey, I like being alive. And I like the people that I hang out with. And I would prefer that we all remained alive in a relatively stable sort of state and in a state that resembles those that contributed to our own evolution to the magnificent species that we are today.
Okay.
There you have it.
All right.
While we're at it,
yes,
let's preserve the conditions that led to the evolution of all the other magnificent species that we share the planet with.
Those little red squirrels?
Yes, all of them.
Okay. Listen, I'm hoping that somebody will call us and tell me about what I understand to be demonstration that's going to be taking place today or tomorrow in Portland. If such a person is online or wants to call us or wants to tell us about it, I really would welcome it because I screwed up and didn't get the data, and I know it's on my computer. Hello. Last night?
Yesterday, says Engineer Steve. Was all.
Oh, it was already happening?
So it's over. It's hopeless.
Too bad.
The effort is gone. The ship has sailed.
I don't think that's true. All right. 231-8187.
Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Abe and Joe.
Hi.
Well, I'd like to bring up two points that I seldom hear here. First of all, in California, they have something called Proposition 65. It says here, chemicals known to the state to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm are found in gasoline, crude oil, and many other petroleum products and their vapors. And so I don't think we're going to get past cancer until we get past petroleum. It's with us, and cancer produces, or petroleum produces cancer. But now I'd like to tell you about something that nobody talks about. I'd like to talk about the real vulnerable part of the XL pipeline, and that's Cushing, the Cushing marketplace. Cushing is a place right next to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the bitumen will be mixed with lighter crude and shipped another 435 miles down to the coast. The problem with Cushing is that it's in Tornado Alley.
Oh no!
And Cushing is an endless horizon of giant steel storage tanks, all holding 50 million barrels of crude oil, all surrounded by a spiderweb of pipelines, pumps, and compressors and terminals. Well, it turns out that last year, one of the biggest tornado in the world, as far as it's recorded, went through that area, and it just missed Cushing. It was heading toward Cushing, but it veered off. It was 2 miles wide, a tornado 2 miles wide, and going at 295 miles an hour. That's almost 300 miles an hour.
You're talking about the wind speed within the funnel.
Right, planes take off at 150 miles an hour, and the typhoon we had there, it was like in Philippines not long ago where it wrecked everything, that was 200 miles an hour. This is 300 mile an hour winds, and it turns out that it could wreck everything, and that's not the worst part. It's in earthquake zone. It turns out in 2009 there were 50 earthquakes around Cushing. And then in 2010, there were over 1,000 due to fracking. And it sits on the Wilzeta Fault. That's part of the Cushing area sits on a fault line. And so this thing could be destroyed. The next big tornado, and what's funny about that is that it took global warming, the burning of CO2 to create climate destabilization that creates these big tornadoes. And so I advise everybody, look up Cushing, and look up the El Reno, E-L-R-E-N-O tornado, and get scared, because this is all in harm's way. And I say that where's the profit in a burnt out planet? That's what I say.
Look at all the jobs.
Cushing is the key to the destruction of the XL pipeline by natural forces like tornadoes and earthquakes. It's unbelievable. Check out Cushing. It's so vulnerable. I can't believe that anybody's going to insure this. The biggest tornado in the world almost hit it last time. What's going to happen next time? And it's increasing. These devastating storms are increasing. So this is the worst investment I've ever seen. And get ready to watch Cushing being torn up by a devastating tornado.
Thanks a lot. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, right.
Hey, thank you for the call.
Thanks a lot for the call. And that's adding to my gloomy mood.
All right, then. Who's next, Steve? Who's next? Wendell, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Joe
yeah.
and Abe.
Yeah.
My point is that TransAlta is going to be owning this pipeline.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on United States territory.
Mm-hmm.
So the pipeline corridor is going to be Canadian owned.
Yes,
and particularly, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because the new planned trade agreement, the TPP, will in fact allow a foreign company to own a huge production facility or a huge transportation facility in the United States.
I think that sort of thing is already allowed.
Yeah, generally, but okay. It will become normal.
So, right, so in other words, this 2,000, 3,000-mile corridor is going to be owned by Canada going straight down to Texas.
Not by the nation of Canada, but by a corporation headquartered in Canada, yes.
Oh, that's right, a corporation.
Right. Yes. Yeah, right.
Okay, so in other words, when you trespass onto that property, whose sovereignty is it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think that's going to be so significant. The fact is that law enforcement, either Canadian or American, particularly in the American part, American, will enforce trespass laws.
Yeah, that would be considered to be private property within the United States. So if there was some sort of incursion, then it would be the responsibility of either the United States law enforcement system or its military to take care of it.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's an interesting point.
It is an interesting
point. So I shouldn't be depressed. We're going to stop this thing. Can we stop this thing?
Yeah, sure we can.
Let's stop this thing.
Okay.
How do we do that?
Well, I think you're going to have to go lay down in the path of the pipeline.
Lay down in the path of the pipeline?
That's right.
I'm not.
And I'll keep doing the show here while you're laying down in the path of the pipeline.
Well, your very absurd point makes a point. How do we as a people grab a hold of these obvious environmental degradations and either stop them or turn them around?
Well, here's how we do it. We demonstrate.
That's it?
No. We demonstrate. We write. We agitate. We talk to our friends. We talk to our neighbors. We encourage them to do the same. We continually sound the bell about a cleaner, greener world and the need to move away from the combustion of hydrocarbons to generate our energy. It can be done. It is being done. There was the nation of Denmark. There were a few days, actually. This may seem like a small thing, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. There are a few days during the month of December when the nation of Denmark was able to generate a sizable majority of its electrical needs simply from wind turbines. This can be done. It's a question of will. It's a question of the construction of the right sort of infrastructure. And it's a question of marshaling enough support.
Okay. We have very little time left. If there's somebody who knows about a demonstration taking place. Annie! Bonnie!
Hi. Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie.
We did have a public assembly last night in response to the State Department of over 300 people showed up.
Really?
In the very cold, dark weather.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, we have to do this. Abe's absolutely right. Joining together, there's many climate groups in Portland. This was sponsored by the No KXL Pledge of Resistance. And we are resisting when the final national interest determination comes down from the State Department before it goes to President Obama for the final decision on the Keystone XL. But there's plenty of other issues right here in our carbon corridor, our proposed carbon corridor. So we had No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance folks. We had 350 PDX, Rising Tide, Strong Sierra Club, and Greenpeace support. And there's many individuals who aren't affiliated, but I suggest join one of these climate groups and work.
When is the next? Do you know when the next event is?
Oh, we're just having them all the time, but I've got your email. And
okay,
I'll
just keep sending them to me because I'll put them on the air.
Is there a reference point on the internet where people could go check out the schedule of events?
Well, there is Activate Hub, which is a an activist source for finding out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest Activate Hub. There's several others, but go to 350pdx.org, and we'll turn you on to any organization you want.
Okay. I'm really glad you called with
unity.
That.
Yes, thank you so
All
much.
Right.
Yeah, and listen, I present myself as being in despair and hopeless about this and give you Tarzan jokes. But the fact of the matter is that it ain't over until it's over. And the struggle can become much more interesting and much more important if all of us will join in it and make our opinions and our feelings known. We can win. I really believe we can win. It's getting harder and harder. But it doesn't mean that it's over.
No, and, you know, this has been true for many decades now. Going to demonstrations and protests is a good way to meet attractive people.
I never thought of it that way.
It's true.
Ha. Huh. Okay, so if you want to have a better social life, go to a demo.
You laugh, but it's true.
Okay. Oh, our theme doesn't work.
Exit music
our theme is gone. Oh, no. Well, you stay tuned because this is KBOO, and I want to point out the best music broadcasting in the region.
Thank you all for your phone calls today, and there's still time to beat this thing, so don't give up.
To KBOO's Winter News and Public Affairs Day for Love of a Better World. Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. 10 days.
On Thursday, February 6th, Africa Oye will help kick off our winter membership drive with a live broadcast from Mississippi Records. Dr. Zalm will return to hosting the first show of each month and will be joined by special guest DJs spinning the tracks. Mississippi Records is located at the corner of North Albina and Sumner and will start up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So, tune in from 2 to 4, February 6th, and don't forget to support your local source for the finest in freeform radio, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committing to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirect.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University, speaks on the Olympics, celebration capitalism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a critique of Obama's pro-testing policy in the public schools, commentary by Mark Carlin of BuzzFlash at Truthout, and an exclusive interview with a former Haitian senator falsely accused of killing Haiti's most famous journalist. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dime Roberts interviews Bill Foster, executive director of the Northwest Film Center, about the 37th Portland International Film Festival. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan hosts a digital art panel with Stephen Slapp, Crystal South, and Theo Downs Le Guin. They'll discuss net art, mobile apps, art that exists only in computers, glitch art, and the backlash against software and slick finishes. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. Our membership drive is coming right up. Please help us by becoming a member or renewing. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Celebration capitalism gives a big boost to the security industry and local policing units responsible for preventing terrorism. The Olympics are the biggest peacetime operation most host cities will ever experience. And the role of security officials is to prevent people from marring the celebration or averting attention from the sports and commercialism. Local and national security officials treat the Olympics like their own private ATM, bolstering and militarizing their weapon stocks.
That's Jules Boykoff, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jules Boykoff, The Olympics, Celebration Capitalism. The Olympics are perhaps the crown jewels of sports. The pomp and circumstance, the pageantry and international competition make the games special. They began over 2,700 years ago in Olympia, Greece. They were held in honor of Zeus, king of the gods. Today, the gods are fame, fortune, and national pride. The Olympics are a multi-billion dollar extravaganza. Behind the spectacle of athletic prowess and the patina of global harmony, brass-knuckle politics and brute economics reign. One hears of public-private partnerships in financing the games, but it's often the public holding the bag when costs skyrocket, as they usually do. The 2016 Summer Games will be in Rio. Brazilians are already protesting against the projected expense. But right now, world media attention is on the Winter Games in Sochi, Russia, where gold medals may place second to security issues. Our guest today is Jules Boykoff. He's professor of political science at Pacific University. Before embarking on an academic career, he represented the U.S. Olympic soccer team in international competition. His articles have appeared in The Guardian and The New York Times. He's the author of The Suppression of Dissent, Celebration Capitalism, and Activism and the Olympics. He spoke at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. And now, Jules Boykoff.
I'd like to start off by sharing some of the history of the Olympic Games, focusing less on its glitz and glamour, I think I'll leave that to the mass media, and more on its grizzled underbelly. So today, the Olympic Games are an enormous sports media and marketing event, a festival of top-tier athletics swaddled in both corporate cash and popular approval. More than 219 million people tuned in to NBC